From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent of Lebanese descent and author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. And we're coming to you from his office in New York City. Ali Soufan is regarded as a leading national security and counterterrorism expert and continues to play a significant advisory role on today's more sensitive issues. The Soufan Group puts out the intel brief every day, and you are able to receive it through email. Ali is currently the chief executive officer of the Soufan Group, that's a strategic intelligence consultancy. In his previous position as an FBI supervisory special agent, Ali investigated and oversaw highly sensitive and complex international terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombings, the attack on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding 9/11. Well, 14 years on, the international crises have only increased. A seemingly intractable war in Syria, which has taken more than 250 lives and displaced more than 4 million, a migrant and refugee crisis the likes we have not seen since World War II, and a resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and the rise of the so-called Islamic State, or Daesh, in Iraq and Syria, just to name a few. Well, we'll talk with Ali Soufan about how to best understand as well as to effectively address these challenges, as well as discuss the regional ramifications of the nuclear deal with Iran. Ali Soufan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Ali, the big news this week, of course, is Russia's intervention in Syria, its military buildup, fighter jets, tanks, hundreds of ground forces. And now we know that Russia launched airstrikes in Syria on Wednesday, seemingly catching the United States and other Western officials off guard. But it turns out that evidence suggests that Moscow wasn't targeting the extremist group Islamic State, as they had stated, but rather other opponents of Bashar al-Assad's regime. What are your thoughts about this recent turn of events?
I think Russia is not looking at its campaign in Syria as an anti-ISIS campaign. They are looking at the campaign as a pro-regime campaign, pro-Assad campaign. And I think they send a very strong message from day one when they bombed locations that some of it has nothing to do with ISIS. So you had airstrikes against al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. You had also airstrikes against Ahrar al-Sham, which is an Islamist organization very closely associated with al-Nusra and with al-Qaeda Central. However, it's also independent from them, and Ahrar al-Sham is closely connected with Turkey. So it was a strong message that their campaign is a pro-Assad campaign, not anti-terrorism campaign. The Russians feel the militant groups in Syria, regardless if they were FSA or Islamists or Qaeda or ISIS, everyone who is fighting the regime is going to be, according to them, considered terrorists. Also, the groups that they targeted, I believe they were sending a message to the regional backers. As you know, in Syria, after 4 years of conflict, every group is supported by someone. What a country. And I think bombing these groups was also a strong message from the Russians to the regional backers. It seems after 4 years, Russia found an opportunity to interfere in Syria. Again, the Russians were looking for their national interest in Syria. Remember, Syria throughout the Cold War was a country that operated under the Soviet influence. It continued to be a pro-Russia, and Russia have significant naval bases, especially in the Latakia and Tartus. So Russia has a lot to lose if the Assad regime ceases to exist. But also at the same time, the Russians are very wary at this point, are very wary of the situation on the ground. Remember, you have thousands and thousands of foreign fighters They are not probably worried about the foreign fighters that they come from North Africa or from Europe as much as they worry about the fighters that they come from Central Asia and countries and nations that are considered part of the Russian sphere of influence. You have a few thousands that came from places like Chechnya, Uzbekistan, and so forth. Tajikistan. Also, you have significant amount of recruits that's coming to fight in Syria, and they are already in Syria, who are Turkic from Central Asia. And Russia is very fearful. Russia and China are both very fearful of Turkic nationalism in Central Asia, especially Islamist type of Turkic nationalism of Central Asia. So Russia is looking for its interest, absolutely. Putin always wanted to expand the Russian influence, not only in the region, in the Middle East, but also, as we've seen his actions in Georgia and the Ukraine and so forth. And he found a great opportunity. And you cannot blame him for taking that opportunity.
When you say opportunity, are you saying that he saw what some say is a sense of weakness on the part of the United States or the Western alliance?
It's a combination. I mean, after you have thousands of refugees going to Europe, most of the Europeans now, they understand that the only way you can deal with the issue of foreign fighters, the only way you can deal with the influx of refugees is to basically stop the Syrian civil war. I mean, you can put all the policies in place, but all these strategies, all these programs, all the idea of limiting refugees, how many refugees you take, how can we stop foreign fighters is nothing if the fire is still going on in the Syrian kitchen. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that he realized, that there is no agreement in the West. There is no agreement even between the United States and Europe on how to deal with the Syria issue. So that's number one. So when he comes and say, hey, I'm going to finish that, a lot of people in Europe will be like, maybe we should let him finish it. Let Syria be his problem. Another thing with the Assad opposition, it's still very fragmented. You have the moderates, extremely weak at this point, as we've seen. Most of the people we train, when they cross the border, they give some of their equipments, if not all their equipments, that we gave them to al-Nusra and to al-Qaeda. That indicates a sense of weakness among the moderate opposition. Also, in the same time, I think he realizes that he is at a stage where he can do a lot of bombings in Syria from the air. He, I think, believe, and the Russians know, that air campaign is not enough to accomplish any gains on the ground. Just look at our air campaign for the last year or so. But I think he probably believes that the Syrian army is still at a position to take advantage of the air campaign and air support that he's giving them. It's yet to be seen if they will be successful in doing so. We had a lot of experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think when he was in the KGB, they had a lot of experiences in Afghanistan, and so far it didn't turn up well for either us or them. So there are a lot of things to keep in mind, and I think it's a very dangerous escalation in the conflict. And I think the only people who will be further damaged with these kind of escalations are the Syrian people. Unfortunately, they will continue to suffer.
Indeed. And what some are saying, too, that this might invite blowback. That is, that now that Russia has attacked civilian targets, not the ISIS targets that he said he would. For example, the National Coalition of Syrian Revolution and Opposition Forces are extremely upset and will double down on trying to oppose the Russians. And even some of the more extremist groups may have Putin in the crosshairs. So that also may happen. But again, the fact that they're there is disconcerting, to say the least.
Well, I think Russia is talking about having some sort of a political solution that will include a few regional powers like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and so forth. However, their action today on the ground does not indicate that they are looking for a political solution. I think deeply in his heart, I think President Putin is probably hoping for a military victory on the ground. He's hoping to give the Syrian regime and its allies, to include Iran, to include Hezbollah, to include many of the other groups that are fighting currently alongside the regime, the power, the push that they need to have a political and a military victory on the ground in Syria. I believe that's going to be extremely difficult to obtain.
And indeed, that would also deepen the sectarian divide, the Shia-Sunni divide. So that's another problem. But let's go back to the United States response, Ali Soufan. Of course, back in 2012, even the aftermath of the uprising in Syria, a very peaceful one that President Obama underscored in his address to the United Nations, at which point Bashar al-Assad turned on his own people. And so then there was a peaceful uprising, and they needed more to defend themselves. They needed some arms. They needed some political advice. But it didn't seem to be forthcoming in a substantive way, despite the fact that some of President Obama's own cabinet officials, General David Petraeus, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and others argued that the United States should do more to help the Free Syrian Army, those who defected from Assad's military. And then we had the chemical weapon attack, President Obama's red line, which many lament that he didn't enforce. We have now the chemical weapons deal brokered by none other than Putin's Russia. But Bashar al-Assad continued with horrible barrel bomb attacks filled with chlorine gas. So just quickly looking back, do you think, Ali Soufan, with all your experience, had the United States, the Friends of Syria, done more way back in 2012, perhaps to support the, the opposition forces, would we be in the same place today?
Sure. At the very beginning, there was a true revolution against the tyranny of the regime of Bashar Assad. You know, those kids who demonstrated in Daraa early on and they were tortured and killed by the regime. That's just an indication of the type of opposition that the regime had during the Arab Spring, if you want to call it. And I agree we should have done a lot early on. Also, at the same time, I'm going to be very fair. You know, there's another side of the argument. And at that time, even though I was one of those people who supported General Petraeus or Secretary Clinton, but also at the same time, you have to remember the other side of the story, which most of the American people and most of the world supported. And the idea was, who's going to take over if Bashar Assad falls? The idea was, we just saw what happened in Libya. And can we afford to have another Libya in the middle of the Levant? The idea was that most of the leaders of the Syrian opposition at the time had no connections to the people on the ground. And there was a big gap between the military factions and the FSA factions on the ground and between the leaders who were sitting in hotels around the world talking on behalf of the Syrian people. So there was a lot of confusion that was going on. And I think what happened in the U.S., and in the West in general, we cannot blame it only on the United States, that we thought a lot without acting. And that is probably as bad as acting a lot without thinking. And I think at one point we could have early on coordinated all the regional opposition or all the regional support of the Syrian opposition in a productive way. I think the confusion that was going on at this time of the Arab Spring and what Libyan aftermath, what's happening in Egypt, there was a lot of things happening in the same time. I think it kind of made us very cautious in taking actions. And I believe, the whole world today is paying in a way or another for that.
Indeed, the flow of refugees coming out of Syria.
The refugees, you have also today about 30,000 foreign fighters that's coming from more than 100 countries. Those individuals, are already as extremist as they get. I mean, it makes Afghanistan look like a little league. Afghanistan in, when Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda today have thousands and thousands of followers. The idea of Osama Bin Laden is way more popular today than when Bin Laden was alive. Remember, ISIS, Daesh came out of Al-Qaeda. It used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq. ISIS believed that they are Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, not Zawahiri's Al-Qaeda. So the division between them is a division about leadership, not about ideology. So I think if you look at the map today, if you look at Boko Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, if you look at what's happening with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, in the Sahel region, if you look at the Shabab movement in Somalia, if you look at Ansari Sharia and ISIS in North Africa and Libya and in Tunisia, if you look at Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and how powerful it became, at least after the campaign in Yemen, if you look at the army that al-Nusra have in Syria, if you look at, ISIS and Iraq, most of the Middle East, most of these countries, huge regions in these countries are controlled by violent extremists, controlled by non-state actors. And I think that's going to create significant damage to not only regional security, but also to global security.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan. He's the author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. He's also the CEO of the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based in New York City. And we are coming to you from his office in New York. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook. And don't forget that the Soufan Group also produces the Intel Brief on a daily basis if you want more analysis from the Soufan Group on these issues about which we're talking. And back to you, Ali Soufan, to continue our discussion about this violent extremism that seems to be on the rise, whether it's the Islamic State, Boko Haram, as you said, Saddam Shia, and all
which is also a faction of Al-Qaeda.
Right. And we're seeing, you know, just these groups on the rise, and even their presence on the internet. We have yet to be able to really combat their recruitment. What's going wrong in your view, Ali Soufan?
That's a good question. I think in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we developed a set of tactics to deal with the threat, to prevent another 9/11 from happening. We did not develop a comprehensive strategy to deal with the incubating factors that led to the events of 9/11 in the first place. So we didn't focus on the narrative. We didn't focus on the ideology. We didn't focus on the recruitment. We focused on how can we prevent terrorism from happening again? How can we prevent terrorist acts from happening again? So I think we've been successful tactically, but all these tactical successes towards the end led us to a strategic failure. And we're dealing today with that strategic failure. We're dealing with an ideology and a narrative that is very widespread in the Muslim world. And I think what we need to do today is to go back and deal with the incubating factors that is leading to extremism in the region. These things are economic factors, cultural factors, educational factors, the issues of rights and equality and justice. All these things have been missing for a long time in the Middle East. And what the Arab Spring did, the Arab Spring took away dictators. However, the Arab Spring was not able to provide a new leadership to a lot of these countries, provide alternative to these dictators that we get rid of. So what you have today in the Middle East and in North Africa, you have a vacuum. And unfortunately, extremist groups and the extremist narrative are the only people who can fill that vacuum. So if you look at everything that you mentioned earlier, these things are not the disease. These are the symptoms of a disease. AQIM, AQIP, al-Nusra, Ansari Sharia, those are symptoms of a disease. And we need to deal with the disease in order to get rid of the symptoms. We cannot just put a Band-Aid on cancer.
Well, that's an excellent point. And that leads me to talk to you about Iraq in particular. Now we have Iraq partnering with Russia and Iran and Syria on intelligence in order to combat Daesh. But it seems to me counterintuitive because the very forces that could really combat Daesh would be Sunni forces. So that leads us to wonder, what about the political situation in Iraq? Why aren't we hearing more about how to help integrate the Sunni population in Iraq more than we're hearing now from the new Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi? What are your thoughts with respect to how we can combat, again, these forces, in a state like Iraq?
The issue is not a domestic issue. what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in many different places across the Middle East, those are regional conflicts that take place. Sectarianism is being used as a tool in these conflicts, but conflict in nature is not sectarian. So you have a vacuum that happened in the Middle East, and now who's going to fill that vacuum? You know, when we decided to pull out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan, we created a vacuum. The Arab Spring created a vacuum. Now, who's going to be filling that vacuum? Is it going to be Gulf states? I mean, by filling it geopolitically, you know, with the geopolitical influence. Is it going to be Turkey? Is it going to be Iran? And Russia definitely found an opportunity also to come back to the region. So you have a regional conflict that now becoming also an international conflict. So in Libya, for example, you don't have Shia and Sunni. Libya, all of them are Sunnis. Yet you still have a big division in the east and the west of Libya. Tribal division, regional division, and so forth. In Egypt, there is no Sunni and Shia. All of them are Sunni. All of them are the same sect of Sunnis. Yet, you still have a very significant conflict in the Sinai and in other places. If you want to talk about ISIS and the Sinai and the Muslim Brotherhood in general with the regime. So you have a regional vacuum that's happening, and Iraq is a perfect example. We're there for more than 10 years. We spend $1 trillion in Iraq. We spend blood in Iraq, sweat in Iraq, treasure in Iraq. And what do we have today? We have the Iraqis having a command post with the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah and working together and sharing intelligence together against the common enemy, ISIS, allegedly. But this is a situation on the ground. These conflicts are rooted in history. These conflicts are rooted in wars that took place between the 1600s until World War I, wars between the Ottomans and the Persians, wars between the Shia and the Sunnis and the Arabs and the Kurds and the Turks. And if you look at the conflict today, you see even the terminology that's being used are terminologies that was used back in the 1600s and the 1700s. I'll give you an example. If you look at the violent extremists from the Sunni side and the terminologies that's being used, they never mention Iran. They never say Iran. They always say the Safavids, a Safawiyin, they call them. Well, that family ruled Iran in the 1600s. You know, then you have Pahlavi came after, and now you have the mullahs, but they still use the same terminology to refer to Iran as a terminology of the conflict that took place in the 1600s and the 1700s. So you have a lot of issues being brought up again, also from the other sides, among the minorities, for example, in Syria, and among the Shia, and among the Kurds, and among the Armenians. You hear a lot about the Ottomans, that the Ottomans are coming. You know, they refer to Turkey as an Ottoman. So there's a lot of things. This conflict is rooted in history more than in the present time. And I think what's happening today, a lot of regional powers and international powers are taking advantage of that history to see how much each one, if they're going to score. Because eventually, there will be a new Yalta, not necessarily a new Sykes-Picot. And during this new Yalta, all the regional power, the international power is going to sit on the table, and there will be a new type of a Middle East or a new type of a new world order, if you want to call it. And I think what Putin is doing today is Russia is trying to, in his mind, make his piece a little bit bigger.
Speaking of a new Middle East or a new arrangement, to what extent do you think that the deal with Iran will also have a major impact, and not just on the nuclear side, hopefully, you know, should that come to fruition, but the so-called windfall that Iran may get if it complies, you know, with the deal's, you know, parameters. Many in the region, particularly the Sunni states, are concerned, Israel as well, that they will use, you know, the windfall to prop up their proxies, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I think Iran, especially after the deal, is definitely now a regional power. The Iran deal should have another parallel strategy by the United States and by the West in order to curtail any kind of Iranian destructive actions in the area. And I think we gave so far a lot of support and a lot of guarantees, not only to Israel, but also to the GCC on this. I think we need to see more actions on how this strategy to curtail Iran and prevent them from expanding their destructive influence in the region. We have to figure out how this strategy is going to work out, because that's the only way our allies in the GCC, Israel, all the other nations in the region, that's the only way that they will be more confident and they will be more trustful of how the future is going to be. Other than that, everybody is going to do whatever they're going to do, and you're going to have a lot of proxy wars going on, as we see today in Yemen, in Syria, and Iraq, and many other places.
Let's conclude with Syria as we started. How do you think the United States and its allies should respond to the escalation by Russia? And of course, Iran is backing, no question, Bashar al-Assad. U.S. President Barack Obama, even Secretary of State John Kerry, talk about a potentially managed transition. That means that Assad would potentially stay for a while, notwithstanding he's a major source of the violence. We have also former General David Petraeus saying that the United States should have a strategy to stop the barrel bombs by Bashar al-Assad, that perhaps we should set up enclaves or free zones, safe zones in Syria, but that would require not necessarily boots on the ground, but true military force. Do you see any of that happening? Would you agree with that? What are your thoughts about how to put the place back together?
I think at this point, the issue is not an issue of more military or more bombing. I mean, look, Syria has seen a lot of bombs. Everybody is bombing everyone in Syria. We had a war that has been going on for 4 years. We have hundreds of thousands of people who were killed and injured. We have millions of people who are internally displaced or refugees. We have influx of refugees coming out of Syria to Europe. I think the situation at this point is we need to figure out how to do a political solution in Syria. And political solutions, that means nobody is winning, or at least nobody is taking everything that they want. You know, everybody is winning and everybody is losing at the same time. And I think they need to figure out how to put that place together. And that's not an easy feat. The sectarianism that's taken place today, the massacres that took place today on all sides, it's going to make it extremely difficult to have a united secular Syria. And I think the only way forward will be through some sort of a political solution. And
But we've tried that before. So many Genevas. The problem is,
every country in the region has its own people. So in order to make a political solution among the Syrians, you have to get all these countries that's supporting all the different factions, to include Russia, to include Iran, to include the Gulf states, to include Turkey, and they have to agree among each other. So instead of thinking about bringing the Syrian opposition and the Syrian regime together in Geneva, let's cut through the chase. Let's go to the backers of these individuals and put them all around the table and try to figure out how to move forward. Otherwise, it's, to be honest with you, it's going to be a waste of time. And now this conflict is going away from being a regional conflict to being an international conflict. I mean, if you don't believe it's an international conflict, look at all the countries that bombed Syria already. We bombed Syria. Russia is bombing Syria. France bombed Syria. The UK bombed Syria. Saudi Arabia bombed Syria. The UAE bombed Syria. Qatar bombed Syria. Do you want me to go down? I mean, it's just like, this is not a domestic conflict anymore. It is a regional conflict, and now it's becoming an international conflict. And the only way to solve conflicts like this with so many different players, with so many different actors, both domestically and regionally, and now internationally, is through a political solution. And I think Putin and Russia is going to learn that the hard way.
And who should take the lead in helping to forge that?
I think the United States and Russia, I think we need to work together. I don't believe that there is any way forward. If you look at Geneva, for example, we included the GCC, we included the Syrian regime, but guess what? We included the Friends of Syria. We didn't include Iran. Iran is probably one of the most powerful players at this point in supporting the Assad regime. So definitely the Geneva meetings, it's just going to be on paper.
Ali Soufan leads the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based in New York City. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. Ali Soufan, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Dan Brody. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.